The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question or a comment for us, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. And now, here are Dave, Jeff, and another amazing guest on the Vet Tech Cafe. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. Dave, how are you out there?
I'm doing great. We're in winter now, and it's actually starting to get cold again. I know last time we talked, it wasn't all that cold here, but now it's starting to get a little bit cold, and I'm not too happy with that. But we're at the end of January. What is today? The 31st.
Of January,
So
for some people, it's January 779th.
Yeah, it does feel like that. No, but things are going great down here. How's things going up there?
It's going well. Still late fall / early spring, not winter to be found very much up here, but otherwise it's going just fine. And yeah, I don't really have any complaints. So
that's great.
You know, we talked very recently, we had a Vet Tech Tap Room episode about the proposed fee increases for RVTs and veterinarians in the state of California. And we got word yesterday, we had a couple of California RVT Association board members that were at the California Veterinary Medical Board meeting in Sacramento this week. And we got word that the fee increase was unfortunately approved. So for applications, licensing for veterinarians and veterinary technicians and premise permits in the state of California, massive fee hikes were approved. But I do want to say that there were over 500 letters sent in that 5-day public comment period, which is the most they've ever received during a public comment period for any sort of measure they've been trying to pass. And that's really, really awesome, because I strongly believe a lot of our listeners,
I do too,
you know, sent in letters. I know people from out of state did. So
yeah.
I really want to take a minute and just say thank you from the bottom of my heart as a California native, and where I'll be going back to at the end of the year. But I also want to say that the work is not done, because this was an emergency filing, and there is a chance that the fees could either be reduced or maybe even reduced back down to where they were. We don't have an idea of when that may take place, but as that would be a normal filing, there would be actually a 45-day comment period.
Much more time for us to do something about it.
In the not too distant future. So we're going to be monitoring that situation. California RVT Association is monitoring that really quite closely. And as soon as that 45-day comment period, I know you and I will announce it on here. And if you don't already out there, follow the California RVT Association on Facebook if you're interested in this. Please feel free to do so. It'll be announced on there as well.
Well, it wasn't just us that promoted that. We, you know, as we shared it, other people started to share it too. I know Yvonne and Jordan from the internal
Vet Med Technicians podcast.
Right. Their podcast also promoted that as well. And I know they're, they had some say in that as well.
Yeah, for sure. And so we got 500 letters in 5 days. When we have 45 days available to us, we want to flood their offices with letters. And one last thing, I know, you know, especially those, again, that are in California that'll be dealing with this, I know you're mad, sad, frustrated. Feel free to write your letters now. And you can send them if you really want to. Just realize that until that public comment period opens, it might get read and somebody might feel bad, but it's not really going to count for anything.
Right.
So write your letters now while you're ticked off, but save it. And then as soon as that comment period opens, send that one, send two or three more, and just keep sending them for 45 days and hopefully they'll get their point. And we'll have to get our guest's thoughts on this as well. I know he's an export now out of California, but he does have some ties there. So I guess let's go ahead and bring out Stephen. What do you say, Dave?
Yeah, let's bring him out.
All right. So our guest today, we're so excited. I'm sure everybody that's listening has heard of Stephen Sattal. He's an RVT. I'm going to explain all these letters here in a minute, but just for the sake of all of the credentials, I'll just say the initials. He's an RVT, an SRA, RLAT, VCC, CVPP, and VTS in lab animal. After obtaining his RVT in California, he obtained certification as a surgical research anesthetist, that's the SRA, through the Academy of Surgical Research, followed by a certification as a registered laboratory animal technician, that's the RLAT, through the American Association of Laboratory Animal Science, otherwise known as the AALAS, soon after that. More recently, he became one of the first veterinary cannabis counselors. We're going to be talking to him a lot about cannabis and veterinary medicine today, out there educating veterinary professionals about the safe and effective use of cannabis in the clinical setting. And he is also a VTS in research anesthesia and is now the Director of Education and Development for LVET Sciences, and is the COO of the very popular Facebook group, Veterinary Anesthesia Nerds. He speaks at several conferences every year. He was just down at VMX in Orlando last week and has written countless book chapters and journal articles and done all kinds of podcasts. We're so happy to have him here today. Steven, how are you?
I'm well. How are you guys?
Just great. Just great. Thank you. What can we get you for a cup of coffee?
Oh, coffee.
Or your caffeinated beverage of choice.
Caffeinated beverage of choice. Let's do a Red Bull potato water.
What?
Whoa.
What is that?
That is a Red Bull. This brings me back to my young years when I used to go to the 18 and up club after after class and used to be exhausted, and I'd get a Red Bull, and potato water is our fun term for vodka. So I'm not really in the mood for coffee right now because it is Friday.
When you said potato water, in my mind I was thinking like the water that you get after you like boil potatoes to cook.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Oh God, no. Yeah, I got that from one of my favorite drag queens I used to watch. She'd yell at the bar back, give me a potato water. And so I've always
that's great.
Stuck with that since then.
That's I'm going to start calling it that.
Yeah.
So we always kind of start out with, I'll see what I can do about getting you some potato water. So we always kind of start out with our guests about describing their career path, because one of the things that we want to bring light to is the different ways that people get to where they are. And there's so many different things that people can do with veterinary credentials or RVTs or CVTs or what have you. So just kind of describe your path a little bit.
Well, my path is kind of a mess. I've done a lot of things in my relatively short career, and it all began with wanting to become first a paramedic, a human paramedic, and then I found out how much money they don't make, and I was like, all right, let me look at human nursing, and so then I started college and headed down the RN path, and then in one of our courses, we started having to touch people as patients, and my first exposure to people, so I have a weird foot thing. I don't like feet. I particularly don't like man feet, even though I do like men. And we had to bandage and like wrap and tape the athletic team's feet. And I was like, this is too much. And then
deal breaker.
Imagine. Yeah. And then having to go in and do, you know, urinary catheters and people like old people. I was like, this is too much for me. So what was nice about that is, during my high school years, I worked through college. I was working as a veterinary assistant at a local vet practice in Woodland, California, called Woodland Veterinary Hospital. And then I went to a VCA called Greenback Veterinary Hospital, and then merged with Sacramento Veterinary Referral Center, which were all VCA hospitals. I was working as an assistant through them. And I was like, you know what? I really love animals, without a doubt. I really love the medicine and the science part. This is the career path that I am supposed to be in, not dealing with stupid humans that are, you know, non-compliant. You know, they would come in for cancer treatment because they've been smokers all their lives, and then you catch them smoking in your room. You're like, what are you doing? And you know, my empathy for humans is very low. So I decided that probably wouldn't be a good career path, but I was like, you know what? This veterinary thing, I've never wanted to be a doctor. This veterinary thing is really, really cool. Let's explore this. And so I did, and I was back to square one with being a poor paramedic, with being a poor veterinary technician. But then I got my credential in 2009, and I was actually one of the alternate paths. People. So I took the college courses that I had, or the credits that I had that applied to humans, combined it with continuing education that I had to get, and then all the doctor sign-offs through California's pathway, and that's how I got my credential to begin with.
Okay.
And at that point, I was in my first year at working at UC Davis at the Primate Center, which was and is one of my all-time favorite jobs so far. So yeah, that's
great.
That's kind of how I started. And then working at the Primate Center, I had some extra time on my hands at that time and started to do an insert.
What is this extra time you speak of?
Yeah, I wish I knew what that was now, but I was interested in doing an internship at the Oakland Zoo, not as a veterinary technician or anything medical, but just hanging out with these huge ass animals and feeding them and scooping up their poop. I was on a string where I was working with eland, gazelle, vultures, and giraffe. And Amy Phelps, who was my leader, the head zookeeper for that track, she was awesome and put me on all these different other, what are called strings with these different species. And this goes into how I got into zoo medicine a little bit. We needed to anesthetize a giant eland. And a giant eland is like the size of one of the biggest cows you've ever seen. And, you know, it's a small vet team. And I was like, hey, I'm an RVT. I have a lot of anesthesia experience. Granted, never on an eland before,
right.
but I'd be happy to write stuff down for you, you know, watch the machine, do whatever you need. And they're like, yeah, that would be great. And then after that, it was just history. They hired me on as a per diem. So I went into the Oakland Zoo kind of as needed. I covered other people's shifts. And then that turned into a per diem gig with the San Francisco Zoo. And yeah, that's kind of how I got into all these exotic species things, which was one of my, I guess, first namesakes in the veterinary field.
I guess the next question we're going to ask you is, what led you into the research field?
Yeah, the research thing. So I had mentioned working at the California National Primate Research Center. And that was and certainly is still one of my favorite jobs. And it was actually something I never, ever expected or anticipated getting into. A really dear friend of mine who was a veterinary assistant, she's now a veterinarian in the Santa Rosa area, Dr. Lisa Owen. She took a job at the Primate Center, I believe about a year before I did. And she said, hey, you should come check this out. It's really cool. The pay is a little bit better. I think you would really like it. And I was like humming and hawing and saying, you know, animal research really isn't my thing. Not really of interest. And she really encouraged me to look into it and apply. So I did. And I got the job. And I just absolutely fell in love with it. It encompassed everything that I wanted to do in veterinary medicine. Working with a cool species, being on the front lines of groundbreaking research, getting the autonomy. I don't know if you guys are aware, or the general community is aware, in lab animal, we have a lot more autonomy compared to what we can do in clinical practice because these are not animals that are owned by someone of the public. They are owned by the institution or they are owned by the federal government. So technicians can do a lot more in the lab animal space, including surgical procedures.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, I mean, I literally, no joke, I have literally done heart surgery on animals before.
Wow.
And placing stents in the heart and placing stents in other vasculature. So like the autonomy and the job satisfaction you can get in the lab animal setting is just
astronomical. I didn't realize you could do all that.
Yeah. Wow. Plus it's better pay usually. and it's something that technicians and assistants can grow old into. I think we have this chronic problem in the regular clinic setting of being young and saying, oh, we don't do it for the money. And like, you know, we do these long hours and we're wrestling with dogs on the ground and our knees and our backs are breaking. In lab animal, you can enjoy all of that stuff. But as you get older and as your arthritis starts to set in and as your hands become crippled from, you know, restraining animals, you can work with rodents. You can work with zebra fish where you're not having to struggle to hold these animals. Or you can go into kind of the regulatory affairs type positions where you're maybe on IOPOCs or you're doing protocol review and really being the advocate for the animal without necessarily having to be on the clinic floor, which I think is a really cool opportunity that a lot of people just aren't aware of.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I think we have a lot of other questions that we want to ask you, but I feel like we could fill our entire episode just listening to you tell us all the stuff that you've done with lab animals. This all sounds extremely fascinating. Yeah. And
I think the cool thing with lab animals, and I just want to clear up this misperception sometimes, is, you know, people think, oh my God, in the research world, they're torturing animals and whatnot. In the lab animal world, there's at least a minimum of two different regulatory agencies that are ensuring the safety and health of the animals in the research setting. And oftentimes, for really good facilities, there's 4 to 5 regulatory bodies that are assessing how the animals are kept, the medical treatment they're getting. And certainly if it's funded by a federal grant, these animals have way better protections than most of the patients that we have in clinic, which is kind of cool. So I think it's important for people to understand that, you know, not only are we there as veterinary technicians and assistants that can act as advocates for these animals have so many protections from the federal and accrediting bodies that they're well taken care of. So it makes my heart feel better about these animals that ultimately are making this sacrifice to benefit people.
Yeah. I think that's one of the misconceptions is that, you know, you think about research and you think about, you know, back in the 80s, all the talk about they're torturing these rabbits to test out mascara and makeup and things like that. And where I'm teaching, we take our students on a field trip to the Duke lab down here in North Carolina, and they go to the lab and we teach them how to handle mice, how to handle rats, do little procedures on them, you know, and the topic comes up of like, so where's the torture? Where's the bad stuff that's happening? Yeah. And the technicians there are great. And they say, you know, we are here because we love these animals. We love what we do. And it's not like we're putting makeup on these guys. We're actually testing really important things.
Yeah.
And to get that misconception out of people's brains is really hard to do. But I think it's really important work. And I tell my students, if you don't want to deal with owners, because that's one of the other misconceptions, right? I want to work with animals because I don't want to deal with people.
Yeah.
And then you realize that, I got to talk to owners. I got to talk to other people all the time. And if you work in research, there's not as much dealing with people per se.
Certainly.
But I think research is one of those fields that I think if anyone out there that's listening that doesn't want to deal with owners anymore, research is your way to go. And apparently pays better.
Well, it sounds like really good, you know, growth opportunity and just so many different things that you can do under that. That's awesome. I didn't know so much of that. So I want to switch gears a little bit here. I want to talk briefly about veterinary anesthesia nerds. So how did that come about? I actually have the page open right now, and I knew you guys had a lot of members, 45,046 members.
Out of here.
That's pretty amazing. How did that group come together?
So the Veterinary Anesthesia Nerds page was really the brainchild of Tasha McNerney, who I believe you've had on one of your little podcasts.
Not yet, but we hope to.
We talked about her article.
That was a great article. So Tasha McNerney was really the founder of the Veterinary Anesthesia Nerds, and she then brought on Darcy Palmer, who's a VTS in anesthesia, and myself to kind of help moderate the page. And it really just blew up. I think we wanted to create a page that was open and genuine and real and hopefully judgment-free. We are pretty good at shutting down posts that can be non-productive.
Yeah.
and trying to really change the way people are practicing their anesthesia techniques and certainly pain management of patients in hospital. And then the last, 4 or 5 years, we've had a pretty awesome conference
That was the other thing I was going to ask.
All self-sponsored, which is awesome. We pick and choose the companies that we want there because we've used their products. We trust their products. We really like their products. and just try to create this community. You know, it's 45,000 plus members, but I feel like I know so many of these people in person, even though I've only talked to them online, just because it is such a good collaborative community, and more to come. Yeah,
for sure. And if you guys haven't checked it out before, go to their Facebook page, and anything you want to know about anesthesia, be it equipment, be it devices, be it drugs or cocktails, use the search function. You can find, I mean, just threads and threads and threads
we'll post the link to the stuff.
Yeah, we for sure will. But really, really cool page. And as you said, it really is a really great community.
Yeah. And Tasha's doing her own little Anesthesia Nerds podcast now, which is kind of fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
About very specific topics and controversies in anesthesia, which I love it because there's so much out there that to be reevaluate it.
for sure.
So Stephen, switching gears yet again, probably getting into bulk of why we want to talk to you today, cannabis.
Yeah.
So you are a very big, what's the word I want to use?
Pothead?
No, that's not what I want to say. You're a big proponent of it, of it being used in our veterinary patients.
Yeah.
So where are we in VetMed right now, and where do you see it's most beneficial?
Yeah, so that is a big question. And I think when we use the word cannabis, I think there needs to be some specific definitions laid out for listeners, just because it is important and pertinent to federal and state law. So cannabis, in my head, cannabis is the genus of a plant, and it encompasses two other plants that we're familiar with in just general media and certainly legislation, and that is hemp and marijuana.
Okay.
And marijuana is the fun plant that has greater than 0.3% THC that people use recreationally and medically. And then the hemp plant has less than 0.3% THC. So we don't necessarily expect things to get high from the hemp plant. And both of these plants contain the same types of molecules, most notably THC and CBD, but in different concentrations. And where we're at in veterinary medicine is really kind of this renaissance when it comes to understanding and utilizing these sets of molecules from either of these plants. I'm more interested in hemp because I think we can get away from the concerns of THC toxicity a little bit, even though I do believe THC has its place. But you need a lot more experience with those types of products to safely use them in animals, let alone the federal legal status of marijuana, sure. Whether you're in a pro-marijuana state or not, is important to remember as far as our licenses are concerned. But anyway, you know, these sets of molecules were in this renaissance of rediscovering their utility. It was in the 1930s and 20s and even 40s where we had medicines. It was in the pharmacopoeia derived from cannabis. And we used to use them for colic in horses. We used to use them for pain management. We used to use them for sleep. We used to use them for epilepsy, all kinds of things. And then we had this jerk, forget his first name, his last name is Anslinger. He was a known KKK member, racist, who utilized fear and racism to criminalize and demonize cannabis as a whole. In the 1930s, and that's where we saw marijuana and its derivatives thrown on the Controlled Substance Act at Schedule I, which is no medical use or benefit and highly addictive, which is kind of interesting. I'm not trying to sound like a conspiracy theorist or anything, but it's kind of interesting, you know, marijuana and its derivatives for such a long period of time have been at the Schedule I, yet the federal government has multiple patents on molecules from the marijuana and hemp plant as neuroprotective agents and as antioxidants. So we're just a mess when it comes to this regulation. But I think the cool thing now is we do have new companion animal studies coming out looking at the clinical efficacy of these molecules for things like osteoarthritis, for supporting animals that have epilepsy, for supporting animals with dermatological conditions, and certainly supporting normal cognitive function, whether that be a calming effect that an animal might need, or certainly more dramatic things like epilepsy. So lots of really cool science coming out with these molecules in veterinary medicine.
So the research is ongoing. Is that what you're saying?
There's been multiple papers that have been published so far, and there's several studies that are ongoing right now. I believe we have five published PK studies as far as appropriate dosing and safety of things like CBD in particular in dogs. We have one in cats. There's one in horses that just came out. So we are getting this information out, and Colorado State University is put out their pilot study looking at the use of CBD for epilepsy. They're ongoing with another study, and the company I work for, Elevate Sciences, is sponsoring another epilepsy study using a little bit of a different product. And then we have the OA study out of Cornell University. Just so many studies going on right now that it's very, very exciting, and hopefully we'll squash kind of this long-held bias and bad character that we've classified cannabinoids under.
This kind of product is, I mean, it's been around for years and years, but it's kind of relatively new in the terms of we're going to use this now for treating our veterinary patients. Is that true?
Yeah, and you know, going into the semantics again, treating is a pretty big word right now when it comes to utilizing cannabinoids in general, whether it's CBD, THC, or any of the other minor cannabinoids. When we use the word treat, or if a company uses cures or prevents or treats whatever condition on the label or in marketing material, if that product is not FDA approved and they use specific language like treat, cures, whatever, that then makes that product an illegal drug. That makes it an unapproved drug.
Right.
Supplements, animal supplements and nutraceuticals, whether that's a hemp-derived product or one of these other supplements we use, things like dinamarin, things like glucosamine and chondroitin, things like Unin Bio, we cannot, as manufacturers and certainly as practitioners, say we are going to treat or cure your animal with these products because they don't have FDA approval for that. It's this fun game of re-educating everybody on what these things are, first of all, and then also educating them and cleaning up their language in general when it comes to supplements in general, because they fall under this weird supplement nutraceutical category and not necessarily a medicine until they actually do get FDA approval.
So right now these products are listed as nutraceuticals, or are they listed as, what are they listed as?
As supplements or nutraceuticals, okay, exactly.
Okay. Yep.
So what kind of, if, you know, maybe this is some of the things you lecture about or on one of the other Facebook pages, you admin for the Veterinary Cannabis Academy, what kind of, like, I would say maybe recommendations or things to watch out for if, you know, somebody, whether they're a client, whether they're, you know, working in a clinic and they're looking at a product, like label claims, like what are like red flags or any like kind of advice there?
Absolutely. You know, the biggest red flag I have for people is certainly a product that is making label claims.
Okay.
That puts not only the manufacturer at risk, but if a hospital were to carry a hemp product that says good for pain or good for seizures, like that puts the hospital at risk also, because it's not an approved drug. And we have to respect the FDA guidelines, but there is room within those guidelines for these nutraceutical and animal type supplements. So that's a big one. The other one in general is just that there's hundreds, if not thousands, of products out there right now. And for us to discern which one is a good quality product is extremely challenging, even for myself, someone that is very familiar with these types of products. People ask me every day about a new product that I've never heard of, and I'm like, I have no idea. But the reality is I think it's smart right now for us to lean on products that actually do have some of this PK data, that do have clinical studies, that do have safety studies behind them, because that's really the only way we can gauge that a manufacturer is trying to do the right thing by providing a quality product out there. You know, we saw years ago the introduction of glucosamine and chondroitin. And what did Nutramax do? They did a study to show that it works, which is good. And we want to know that these things are safe. So leaning on those companies that have that kind of material for you, I think, is one of the other safeguards that we can do. And then my opinion, and this is the first time I've said it out loud in a public setting, my opinion...
Breaking news.
Oh my God, it is breaking news. My opinion on COAs is evolving. I used to start out these conversations or this answer with, make sure the company provides you with a COA. A COA is a certificate of analysis. And gotcha. On the certificate of analysis, it'll have a breakdown of the cannabinoids that are in there. So it'll give you like the concentration of CBD in there. It'll have terpene analysis on there, which are the smelly part of the plant that I used to think like would help get me high, but it doesn't. And then things like mycotoxin, bacterial counts, fungicide and pesticide analysis. I still think that's important to get from a company. And if a company is unwilling to give you a COA of any type, I would not buy their product. But the problem with the COAs right now is we're finding a lot of companies manipulating them, which is really, really unfortunate. Even some of the third-party ones, and there's even been recent articles showing that these third-party, supposed to be accredited labs, were manipulating the results for these companies so that they were, one, either compliant with federal law as far as THC levels or cleaning up some of these contaminants that could be potentially dangerous to our patients. So, I still think it's important to ask for COA. If the company's unwilling to give you one, I would not buy their product, but I wouldn't rely solely on a COA as far as the end-all be-all for a quality product.
Interesting. Huh. One other question I would have is, you know, there's obviously, there's laws at the federal level, and then there's laws at the state level. And I see online a lot, you know, between still working on the RVT board in California and being here in New England about, in a veterinary practice, talking to clients about these kinds of products. And I know, Dave, down where you are in North Carolina, down in the South, it's a bit different.
Right.
So how do you talk to people about tiptoeing some of those lines?
Yeah, and it kind of depends what state you're in. So North Carolina actually has very, very positive hemp legislation. The only tricky part with North Carolina is they are wanting hemp products being sold within the state to only be sourced from hemp that was grown in North Carolina. So they have very positive hemp laws, but it's a little bit challenging as far as products that you could actually get in North Carolina, especially ones that have scientific backing. In general, especially when it comes to California and some of these other states where people are mentioning that, oh, they can't talk about cannabis products, they can't even suggest or recommend them. By and large, that's not true, and it's really dependent on the type of product that you're talking about. When it comes to cannabis products that are derived from marijuana, so you can have a CBD product that's derived from marijuana, that at the federal level is illegal in every single state. Every single state. California is one of the first states to pass laws where a veterinarian can discuss a marijuana product, but they can't prescribe at this point, and they certainly can't make a profit from it. So marijuana in general, again, I do think it has its place, but it's really, really too sticky for me to really get behind and say, let's just do it anyway.
Yeah.
Whereas hemp, on the other hand, is federally legal. But what the federal government did when they legalized hemp and its derivatives is it gave states the power to legislate how they want to handle hemp in their particular states. I would say a majority of states, certainly at least 44 states, have very positive hemp laws where consumers can buy hemp CBD products. And certainly that is reflected for veterinary medicine as well. The issue that we have in these states where we're hearing these rumors, essentially, about you can't discuss things, is confusion in the law when it says the word cannabis or marijuana or hemp. A lot of legislation specifically says cannabis, which most of the time is meaning marijuana. versus hemp. So I would urge everyone that's interested in the laws in their state to not just take the opinion of their veterinary medical association or even their veterinary medical board, but look up the specific hemp legislation in your state, because I bet you anything, unless you're one of those like five or six states that has not so positive laws on hemp, you're going to find a really good acceptance. You know, New Jersey is a perfect example. It specifically says human and animal use should be, hemp should be used and cultivated to the extent permitted by federal law. Like very, very positive stuff. It's just no one seeing this because it's being drowned out by some of these larger organizations' opinions on these types of products.
Interesting. It's the ins and outs are fascinating.
I just can't stress enough for people, just like anything in veterinary medicine or medicine in general, read it yourself. Like stop taking these rumors on as fact, because a lot of times we're playing telephone and they're getting misinterpreted. Yeah, yeah. They're getting over dramatized or just factually incorrect.
Right.
Gotcha. So you mentioned LVET earlier. So you've kind of transitioned out of the, largely out of the clinical setting into that kind of realm. How's that going? What does it look like for you working for LVET? What is LVET, and what does your job look like?
This has been crazy. I left California in May of 2019. I was at Silicon Valley Veterinary Specialist, which I think is now a med vet of Silicon Valley or something that. I left clinical practice there. I was the supervisor of the surgery team at that hospital. Loved it, and went into industry full time with LVET Sciences. And LVET Sciences is a hemp CBD, CBDA company. This sounds so cheesy, but it's a science first company, and we're not putting out products until we have some safety dosing and efficacy study behind them, which I really, really respect. What I think is particularly cool, especially since this is kind of a tech centered podcast, is okay, let me back this up a little bit. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I've always been known, I think, in the industry, and anyone that knows me, certainly Jeff, we've known each other for several years. I certainly have a tenacious, ambitious, sassy personality, and I really don't like being told what I can and can't do. And I feel like in veterinary medicine, there's so many perceived glass ceilings for veterinary technicians in general. And what I loved about LVET is they hired me as the director of education and development. And in most industry positions, that would be filled by either a PhD scientist or a veterinarian.
Right.
And again, like what I think is really cool about LVET is they saw through all of that malarkey, this general expectation in industry of who should fill what type of position, because they were looking at the person and their actual qualifications and experience. And I'll say it, you know, I have a lot more experience than a lot of these veterinarians out there when it comes to these cannabinoid type products, and certainly looking at the science and being involved in the research. So I really, really respect them for helping me and doing the right thing as a company with hiring the most qualified person rather than just looking at three letters behind their name.
Well, you have how many letters? There's a lot of letters.
It was basically an alphabet.
So Joe Washlog, who's our chief medical officer, he's a DVM, PhD, and he's double boarded in nutrition and sports medicine. And we always joke with each other about who has the most letters after their name. And I mean, when I talked to him on the phone now, he's like, "How's it going, doctor?" I'm like, "I'm not a doctor and I don't want to be one of you, because you guys give me headaches all the time answering all your silly questions." I won't call them stupid questions, but your silly questions. So it's a really fun working environment. I certainly miss practice. Found a referral hospital up here, Maine Veterinary Medical Center, and I said, "Hey, can I just come in and like stick some dogs' jugulars or something?" Like I just have that quench I need to. Or wait, I said that wrong.
Yeah,
I have that desire that needs to be quenched. Well, what is that saying?
thirst that needs to be quenched?
That thirst that needs to be quenched with poking a vein or, I don't know, having a kitten throw up on me or something. I don't know. So I have that escape with a hospital around here. So that's awesome. Nice.
Is that the facility that's in Scarborough?
It is in Scarborough. Yeah.
I have one of the residents that was at Tufts when I first started there as a criticalist there. Megan Vaught.
Oh, awesome.
Megan Vaught.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, she's awesome. I have one more question just about cannabis before we kind of jump into our last topic. So
sure.
Where we are in veterinary medicine, and this might be a little bit difficult to answer, but are there one or two or three conditions with where we're at right now that you see it being most beneficial to our veterinary patients in the near future? I mean, sure, there's a lot of different things that we might be able to do with it in the future, but with where we're at and what you kind of see coming down the pike, like, where do you see it being most beneficial?
Sure. So, you know, pain management is near and dear to my heart. So I think as studies continue to come out and we discover these formulations of these different cannabinoids and terpenes and flavonoids that might be best for aiding in the comfort of animals, I think that is certainly one area or one of the biggest areas of interest, especially because we have so many pet owners that are interested in more natural approaches to caring for their pets.
Yeah, good point.
And certainly animals that don't really tolerate some of the traditional pharmaceuticals that we have, like non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, or animals that are in kidney or liver disease, you know, what's an option to keep these poor animals comfortable?
Sure.
And oftentimes, we as veterinary practitioners, whether that's the technician, the assistant, or the doctor, we're hesitant to use pharmaceuticals on those animals that are maybe a little bit more compromised. But then we get stuck in this vicious cycle of not providing enough care for them based on fear. So certainly keeping animals comfortable is one of the areas of interest. And then certainly kind of the behavioral aspect or cognitive support when it comes to these types of products. You know, anxiety is a big topic when it comes to CBD and cannabis in general. So having a few studies that are in the works come out to really validate that, I think is going to be of huge interest. And I think the last area is kind of tied, in my opinion, with conditions such as epilepsy and certainly cancer. Some of these animals do well on traditional anti-epileptic drugs, and some of them do not do well on these traditional anti-epileptics, or they just need that extra little boost to help them not get through these breakthrough stages. And then, you know, certainly the safety concerns with some of these controlled substance anti-epileptics. So I think that's an area of interest. And then with the cancer thing that's kind of tied, we need way more research before we start throwing on labels and suggesting that we can use these products to stop or kill cancer. Like, I'm not even going to go there. But as far as keeping those animals that are undergoing cancer treatment with traditional chemotherapy agents that are having muscle wasting, that are uncomfortable because they're also arthritic at the same time, or they're not eating, keeping their quality of life at a good point with the addition of cannabinoids, I think, is a huge area of interest.
Super cool. Super cool. Thank you.
That's important. And the last thing that we want to talk to you about, you kind of brought this up when we were talking about interviewing you, is the discussion about diversity. How do you see VetMed in that light right now?
I think we are certainly getting better. And, you know, myself, I am half white and I am half Mexican, but I look kind of Asian. people ask me all the time, oh, are you Hawaiian? Are you Polynesian? Are you Filipino? And sometimes I throw out some of my Tagalog at them just to trick them and be like, yep, I'm Filipino, but I'm not. But power to my Filipino people. we are getting better, but we still have a lot of work to do. I think when you look at some of these boards for professional organizations, whether it's AVMA, NAFTA, some of these colleges, and certainly some of these specialty academies, when you look at the leadership of these academies, you see not a lot of color or not a lot of diversity in general with them. And it's not to say that those people are bad. It's not to say that it has to be colorful all the time. But I don't feel like our profession is mirroring who's actually out there and what our world looks like today. We've seen the development of the Multicultural Veterinary Association, which is really great and encouraging people of color and those maybe that are identified with the LGBTQ community to be involved in veterinary medicine, going to some of those areas that have high densities of diverse communities and educating them, hey, did you know you could be a veterinarian? Did you know you could be a veterinary technician? I think is going to be really critical as we evolve in the veterinary space.
Hmm. Yeah, and I found kind of both ends of that spectrum when I was working in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is not very diverse when it comes to people of color or people of different nationalities. But down here in North Carolina, there's a lot more diversity. And in my classes, I would say we have a much better mix down here. I'm sure it's different all across the country, no matter where we're talking about.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, coming from California, the Bay Area, and then moving to Maine, which is defined as the second whitest state in the union.
What's the whitest? Is it
North Dakota? I think Vermont.
Oh, Vermont. Okay.
Probably, Vermont is, yeah. And there's nothing, again, like I'm not trying to sound like I'm picking on the colored people, but it is interesting, the huge culture shock. I am still kind of getting over moving from California to Maine, you know, just little things that have dramatically changed my life, not being able to get tacos or even the ingredients to cook food that is familiar to me.
Right.
It's so different, and it's an evolving world. We're definitely getting better. Lots of work to do, but veterinary medicine, just like most things on the human medical side, we're a little bit behind on, and it's going to take a little extra effort.
Well, and like you said, it's that leadership role. If people of color or people of LGBTQ, if they're not seeing leaders in those roles, what's going to lead them to say, hey, I want to do that too?
Right.
Yeah, Stephen, it's funny you say going from California to Maine. I feel like even though I went California to Massachusetts, I feel like I actually had the opposite shift because I came from Orange County, which doesn't get much wider than Orange County.
Yep.
And then, you know, to Massachusetts and being in academia at Tufts, where, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, groups on campus, and the diversity there was far more than I had ever experienced before. So it was, even though I went, you know, from California to New England as well, it was like completely the opposite for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I think it's funny that you're from Orange County, because I was just having a discussion with somebody about this, and we were talking about the lack of diversity in Maine. Again, like I'm not trying to demonize Maine at all,
sure.
But it's interesting because my feeling as someone that doesn't look like your average white person, despite being half white.
You don't look like a Mainer.
I don't look like a Mainer, right? But I don't feel, the feeling that you have in Maine is so different compared to Orange County. And I think Orange County is one of those bubbles within California.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're blonde and you've had work done and, you know, all of these typical stereotypical things of Orange County are very true, and they kind of deny a diversity problem. Whereas Maine, they're very, very aware of a diversity problem. They're very aware of a population problem in general. But it's not the same feeling, and I would dare to say uncomfortable feeling, that I would feel in Orange County compared to coming to Maine, where there's also a lack of diversity.
Yeah, yeah. In there, you mentioned, I'm going to mess up the name, but it was Multicultural Veterinary Medical Association. Is that right?
Yes. I will maybe send you guys a link. So
yeah,
you
definitely. Can
yeah,
send people
absolutely.
There.
That was actually what I was going to ask for is what kind of work they do, if you knew or if we could link
it. Yeah, they are at AVMA now. They're building their speaking circuit on diversity issues, how to be culturally sensitive in the workplace. Things that we maybe shouldn't say. How do we deal with those clients that come in with pets that have a obviously racist name? Do we serve those clients? Those clients that make racist, sexist, religious, inappropriate comments. How do we deal with that? So I think the work that they're doing is really, really critical to not only, you know, educate the community, but also to protect our employees and do what's right and ethical in this profession.
Yeah, I definitely want to look into that, and we'll have to link that into the post. Thank you.
Yeah, I wasn't aware that.
I wasn't either. And
well, you're talking to two white guys, so
right, true.
Why would we? Know
but
that,
you know, right? I mean, Dave, you work with you teach veterinary technician students, and I work with future veterinarians as well. So they may be aware of it, but maybe not. So that's really good.
I'd love to bring that to my students too, to let them be aware of it too.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, Stephen, I think we're just about out of time. I don't want to take up any more of your precious time. I know you want to get to your potato water. Well, but we have one more question for you.
Sure.
Jeff, I think we need to switch the random question because the one we're going to ask, you already answered.
You kind of touched on it a little bit already.
Our question was going to be, what's the biggest difference besides the weather between Maine and California? But you've kind of already answered that.
Oh, that was such a boring question anyway. Jeez.
All right. So then we'll spice it up a little bit. So if you were to go on to America's Got Talent for an audition, what would your talent be?
What would my talent be if I went on to America's Got Talent? Okay. Oh my God. So many breaking news moments in this podcast. I think most people who know me would say, oh, maybe he's going to go do some sort of dance or something.
That's what I would assume. Yeah.
I think the reality is I would want to challenge myself. And this is one of my biggest. So I speak in front of, thousands of people every year, several conferences a year. Public speaking is not scary to me, but singing in public is absolutely terrifying to me. I get invited to these karaoke things and I absolutely turn them down. But I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I do think I have a pretty good voice. So I would challenge myself to sing on America's Got Talent.
And any particular style of music or song or anything that you think you could just get up there and belt out?
So here's another silly thing. If I could choose any other career other than being an attorney, I would want to be a mariachi singer. So I would love to do a Spanish song, a mariachi style song. That's what I would do.
That's great. And do
fantastic.
You have, is there video of that? Because we need to see that.
I might die if someone ever made a video of me singing. I'll never forget in high school, I used to sit in the car and record myself on my parents' video camera singing, but I had the headphones in, so you could only hear my voice. And I remember one day I heard my parents laughing and I heard myself singing, and they discovered the tape that I would sing on. And they were watching it, just cracking up. And I was, ever since then, I was mortified. So I think that's where I get my PTSD when it comes to singing in public. Oh,
if your parents are listening, please, please, please send us that tape. We would love to listen to it.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to come by the Vet Tech Cafe and have a cup of coffee with us. And I don't know if I'll get to see you before IVEX. Are you going to be at IVEX this year or TBD?
TBD.
Okay. Okay. Well, hopefully our paths cross at some point before I leave New England. And if nothing else, actually, I'll be up in Portland next weekend, coming up for the day to go do some beer tasting. So
nice.
Yeah. So hopefully I get up there and at least see you for a beer or a glass of wine or something, if nothing else.
Some potato water.
I love that.
Or some potato vodka.
Potato water.
All right. Well, thanks again, Stephen. We really appreciate your time, and we'll talk to you again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dave. And thanks, Jeff.
All right. Thanks. Dave and Jeff would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As we talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by Dave, Jeff, or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have any questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.